Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 9th of August, Anno Domini 2014, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Steve Ray. There we are. Okay,
Oh, and I'm Phil Dodd.
And we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Phil Dodd is sitting in for Dave Enright, who's one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest. And so far, he's doing a great job.
You've been with the station a really long time, haven't you? You were in that picture that Rob sent out this week of the oldies, he called it.
Yeah, I'll have 20 years next May.
Wow.
Is that all?
That's all, yeah. I mean, you know, the polka guys, 34, 35, and, you know, so.
Yeah.
Derek Lucas has been doing a Miles Davis special live recordings on a Labor Day weekend, and I was talking to him about it, and this Labor Day it'll be number 25.
Nice.
I think he started at the station when he was 7.
Yeah, I think so too. Speaking of Labor Day being 25, our 25th anniversary is coming up. And we will be broadcasting live from Love and Cup on, what's the day, the 30th? Yeah, the 30th of September. The actual date is the 30th of August. The actual date is the 3rd of September, but that's a Wednesday. So we picked the Saturday before that. So it's going to be a whole live thing with lots of cool stuff. And we'll be taking people's questions live. As well as on the air. So I think it's going to be just plenty of exciting fun. That's the 30th of August. The regular time, noon to 2, we'll be getting there a little early and leaving a little late. but that's the deal. I think it's going to be plenty of fun. All right, let's get to the news. Don't forget, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. The FCC on Tuesday proposed changing the definition of high-speed internet to require download speeds of 10 megabits per second or higher to qualify as broadband. The commission currently divides broadband, or high-speed internet, as 4 megabits per second download speed and 1 megabit per second upload speed. The agency will seek public comment on whether those threshold connection speeds should be increased. In a notice of inquiry released on Tuesday, the FCC suggested that download speeds might need to be 10 megabits per second to qualify as broadband and asked whether the minimum upload speed rate should also be higher. U.S. consumers are increasingly using the web to stream music and videos or for interactive services and applications that continue to demand faster speeds. For instance, the popular service Netflix Inc. recommends a 5 megabit per second internet connection speed to stream video in high definition. The FCC has the authority to regulate internet service providers such as Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T as it oversees the rollout of broadband services to all Americans. And I quote, in a reasonable and timely fashion, as directed by the U.S. telecommunications law. The FCC's annual reviews have found that a notable portion of the U.S. population, particularly in rural areas, lacks access to high-speed internet. A higher speed threshold for broadband, if adopted, could mean an even smaller part of the U.S. population is deemed as having access to broadband internet. It could also reduce the areas of the country where the FCC considers high-speed internet to be available. In its latest report on progress in broadband deployment in 2012, the FCC found that 19 million, or 6% of Americans, lacked access to fixed broadband service. In rural areas, the FCC found 1/4 of the population without access to such high-speed internet. The agency will now collect comments on a potential change of broadband definition for 45 days as it prepares a new broadband progress report. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. How fast should high-speed internet be? Your choices are 1 gigabit per second, 100 megabits per second, 10 megabits per second, 5 megabits per second, and ludicrous speed.
Never show that part again.
Yeah. So far, we've got 23 votes. And, of course, ludicrous speed is leaving because... I knew I shouldn't have put it in. I wanted to know what people really actually thought. So you can write whatever you want there, but also you can...
What do they have in, like, Europe? What, Norway's got 100 gigabit, and they're working on terabit?
Yeah.
That is ludicrous, and I want it.
And I want it. right. We're a third world country when it comes to internet speeds. And I know you have a lot more to say about this, so check out our forums down on the right. If you pull down on the right, you'll see fascinating stuff. Under that, you will see the forums. If you select that, you'll see several of our forums listed, including poll discussion. Under poll discussion, what you'll find is that the first one at the top of the list is 9 August 14, how fast should high-speed internet be? And when you enter your comment there, and I hope many of you do, when you enter your comment there, please don't forget upload speeds as well. Not just how fast should the downloads be, but how fast should the uploads be as well.
Well, when we first defined broadband, it was anything faster than 53K.
Right,
because we're used to modems, and so you know 1,000 megabit, you know, or 1,000 K, you know, 1 megabit line was ludicrously fast, and that's the way a lot of the early internet providers talked about it. It's 100 times faster than dial up. That's 500 K, and we wouldn't treat 500K as broadband these days, would we?
No, we would not.
I'm mad that my 10,000 K is slow.
Yeah, right, right, right. Of course, we who have, back in the day when I was working at RIT, we had gigabit Ethernet to all the buildings and 100 megabit to the desktop. That was nice and fast. Now, of course, I'm desperately, desperately waiting for green light to come to my neighborhood. Do you hear that?
Yep.
All right. But even so, those of us who were on the very fast internet, we're not on the fastest internet that there is. Currently, the fastest internet that there is ESNet, the Energy Sciences Network, which used to be 42 megabits per second, but I think is now up to 91. They've gotten data across it at 91. That may have just been a test. Gigabits, I mean, 41 gigabits, 91 gigabits.
I just found an article that UK researchers have got 1.4 terabits running.
Right, right, right.
Yep.
So
in the lab, it's god-awful fast. But the annoying thing is the U.S.
No, I believe that actually was, that test was done over ESNet.
Oh, was it?
I think so. If it's the one I was thinking of, I didn't realize it was done by UK people, but so maybe it isn't. But it's ridiculously fast.
Yeah. Well, and one of the annoyances is U.S. ranks number 3 in the world with an average of 7 megabits. Because we have Google Fiber in some cities at 1,000, and some cities have zero broadband, and so the average is 7. So if all these cities have 1,000, the average is 7.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot of them with very low speeds.
Right.
What is green light?
Green light is fiber network to the home, and it's 100 megabit for, what is it, $50 a month or $70 a month? I should probably actually look at that.
Yeah, I'm bringing it up. Yeah.
Thanks.
So, their slow service is 100 megabits, and their fast service is 1,000. Let's see who can Google it faster.
I think I'm trying to bring up the actual site itself.
Yeah, $50 a month for 100.
Yeah, there you go.
$250 a month for 1,000. Generally, that's
a gigabit.
A gigabit, yeah. That's generally for like apartment buildings. So all the apartments would split that 1,000. But if you want, you know, a gigabit to your house, you just have to run the fiber line. Now, Green Lights is running fiber. They're working in 12 Corners, Brighton area, I think.
Yeah,
it was.
They're not working in my neighborhood yet.
Yeah. So Green.
Let's get that straight right now.
Greenlightnetworks.com. So if you want to sign up for service, they put your name on an email list, and that tells them what neighborhood to go to next, what neighborhood you're in.
I've argued this with them. They sign up for service is a bad way to put that.
Yeah, learn about or something.
Right.
Yeah.
What it really is your declaration that you're interested in the service. Then what they do is whenever they're ready to open up a new neighborhood, they look through the list and see how many people in each neighborhood, and they go for the top one.
Yeah.
But that does not obligate you in any way to actually
pay for the service.
Yeah. It just says you're interested. So my hope, we've had several people in the Upper Monroe Neighborhood Association get a bunch of door hangers. They beat me to it. So
yep.
Everybody and all you umnuts out there, get out there and go to greenlightnetworks.com and say that you're interested in the service.
One thing that's interesting is they're now advertising 100 times faster than regular internet.
Yeah.
Because the typical internet in Rochester is 10, and right. So they'll give you 1,000.
Right.
So we're still 100 times faster than typical.
Well, but now these are all weasel words. Typical, average. And
up to.
Right. But yeah, I would love to have 100 megabit to my house again. I'd kill in public to get gigabit. But
if you want to pay the what is it, $10,000 a foot?
Yeah.
To get the fiber to your house now, you're more than welcome to.
Yeah, I do. I do understand that. I do understand that. Once again, however, I've had our local cable provider out to my house every couple of years. Squirrels chew through the insulation. And I start getting bleed and pixelation and everything else because I live in the shadow of Pinnacle Hill. And they come over, and every time it's the same. You know, you think they would have some sort of history, some sort of thing they can go back and look at, some sort of, I don't know, what would I call it, a computer database, maybe.
Yeah.
But every couple of years, they come to my house, I call them and tell them the squirrels have chewed the line. They send somebody over, checks every box in the house, every connection in the house, the connection at the side of the house on the outside. And then the guy will listen to me when I tell him, get on the ladder and go up and look that it's chewed the wires. And he'll go up and he'll go, yeah, you're right. We'll have somebody fix that. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I remember my dad fighting squirrels on the bird feeder.
Oh, yeah.
And trying to, and all over the internet, you can buy squirrel resistant bird feeders, and none of them are.
None of them
and
are.
And I've seen some really ridiculous experiments where it's a 50 stage obstacle course. And within a couple of days, the squirrel figures out how to get to the bird feeder.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The ones I've seen
they get in a car and drive down a track and then get out.
Yes.
They figure it out.
But they can. One I saw is it twirls. If the weight is too much, if it's, you know, because birds are light. But if a squirrel gets on, it pulls it down one of those corkscrew things, and the thing twirls and twirls and twirls and throws the squirrel off.
Well, then they use it as an amusement ride.
Yeah, right. They're not bothering. Problem is, it also throws off a lot of the seeds.
Yeah.
So I'm not entirely sure what you gain from that.
Yeah, which then they can eat on the ground. So
right.
one sacrifice, take one for the team, and then the rest of the squirrels can come out.
And I will tell you, it probably took 14 seconds for my cats to figure out where to sit under the bird feeder in the corner.
Yep.
Waiting for the birds to go grab the seed that's on the ground.
Yep.
Yeah.
But back to the fiber for a minute. There are other companies in Rochester doing fiber, but they're doing it for commercial and enterprise customers.
Right.
And so it's just priced out of range for home use.
Right.
Which is why we're really excited about a home price capable fiber network.
Yeah, we're very excited. Perhaps too excited, admit that. But there are a lot of providers across the country who have been doing fiber, faster, much faster internet, and of course, even with copper, There have been experiments that show you can do much faster connection through copper as well. The problem is, of course, cost. Particularly when you're talking about using copper, you have to have very high-grade copper and well-insulated, and you have to really worry about the devices in the middle, the routers, the switches, all of that stuff has to be very high-end, which, of course, translates to very expensive.
And especially here in Rochester, where we have 100 years of Rochester telephone copper wire running everywhere, it's not inexpensive to try to rewire everything.
Right, right. And that's part of our issue all across America is the aging infrastructure.
Yep.
When Frontier, Rochester Telephone, back in the day, put in all of those wires, they were high-end, high-grade, best you could get stuff. That was 100 years ago.
Yeah.
We've gone a ways since then. And still, the network is fine for voice, which is their mandate.
Yep.
Right? So, you know, being able to add all these services is nice, but it's not their mandate, and that's part of that issue. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Nick Francesco, Phil Dodd, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And that's Phil Dodd.
Okay. We do it every time.
Every time.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So without you, the show wouldn't be running.
That's exactly right.
We just leave
right.
the mics open all night.
Okay.
And we're not sure how many of our listeners have long-term memory retention anymore, so always repeat.
Since I haven't actually done calls, we do have a caller. I'm hoping he's there.
It's Mike from Altoona, PA. Hiya, Mike. What's up?
Oh, the jig here.
Yeah, the jig
sounds like it's
up.
Warmer in Rochester. We only got 74 here.
Oh, I am sorry. We're doing pretty nicely up here today.
Yeah, we don't have a Liberty pole either.
That's right.
Hey, but the question I have for you today, you know, is what they dub a secure website. You know how when you look up on the top of your URL, it says HTTPS?
Right.
Yeah.
And that supposedly designates you're in a secure website.
Yep.
Now, can a bad guy start a secure website?
Well, here's the thing. A secure website requires a certificate. From one of the many, and there are dozens and dozens of places.
The Hong Kong Post Office is a certificate authority.
Right. So anybody can buy a certificate. Anybody can put up a website that they say is secure. That doesn't mean legitimate. However, in most systems, you can look up at the URL line and see the little lock there and click on it, and it will bring down information about the certificate that they're using at their end.
There's kind of two halves to secure, depending on how you define secure. The S means it's encrypted. So the data is encrypted on your computer, sent over the public internet, and decrypted on the other computer.
Right.
And then there's the validation that the other computer is who they say they are. So when you go to, like, your bank, you can look at your certificate and make sure that the certificate is in the name of the bank. Because the bad guy can make a secure certificate, and you can make a secure connection to a bad guy.
Well, since you mentioned that, that's exactly what happened to me. When I went on to do my online banking, and I was using a computer I don't normally use, the bank's website, where their name was up in bold, by the way, cued me for my security question, which I answered. Then I got transferred to another website, which also said HTTPS, only my name's bank was no longer in bold, and there was some, just say, a mythical banking services or whatever.
Right.
So I smelled a rat and backed out. But I'm wondering how this could happen, because in my bank, particular one I deal with, there's like an image, a picture image, and also a phrase. And if that doesn't show up, they say back out, and that's what happens to me.
It's very easy to fake a website, the look of a website. And what bad guys will often do is they will make similar named websites. So you're trying to go to PayPal, and the bad guy gets PAYPA1.com.
And yeah, it had the actual number after it.
Like, to the casual observer, that's close enough. Yep. The other issue, too, is if you're on someone else's computer, well, even your own, but you might already be clean there. There might be a Trojan or virus in the computer already that's capturing your information before it gets encrypted to the website. And that may be what happened to you if you were on an unfamiliar computer. So
equally important, some of the viruses these days will change the host file. Every computer has something called a host file. Most of them are empty. But in general, your network connection looks there first to see where it should go when you type something into the URL line. So, for example, on my machine at home, I can, I can set it up by changing the host file so that if I type google.com, it actually takes me to yahoo.com, because I've told the host file, when you see google.com, go to yahoo.com.
Okay, I get you, and that's probably what they did to me.
Well, they did it on purpose or they got a virus that did it for them.
Right. And misspelling is a good, too. Google.com. is a common misspelling of Google.
Goggle.com.
That, like you say, a porno site or whatever.
Well, I got a little pop-up that said, congratulations, you're the lucky visitor. Click OK.
One other quick question, though. Like,
okay, I'm a little worried about clicking OK.
Hold up on the URL. Is the relative position of that significant? Does it always have to be first, or can it be like the second or third name down in the chain?
Well, generally speaking, it would be the first name in the chain.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes back to where they bought their certificate from, which is usually a top-level certificate authority, but sometimes it can go through a couple of steps first.
Okay, I understand.
Right, so for example, I clicked on the lock. I went to M&T Bank, mtb.com. It says the identity of M&T Bank Corporation at Buffalo, New York, U.S. has been verified by eTrust Certification Authority, L1E, but does not have public audit records. And then it tells me that the connection is encrypted with 128-bit encryption. It uses TLS 1.0. It's encrypted using RC4.1. And it goes on and on and on about what it does.
And average people aren't going to know what any of that means.
Right,
it's part
of the
problem.
Is you can at least go there and say the top one, which is in English, says the identity of where you think you went has been verified by eTrust, which is one of the most well-known certificate authorities around.
Yep. I went to Kennedy National Bank, it's signed by VeriSign, which is also one of the more well-known ones and one of the most expensive ones.
Mm-hmm.
you can always click on that HTTP header information to make sure that it's encrypted and signed. So that's the two halves. The data is encrypted so nobody can sniff it. And it's signed by the person who it says it is. So you're actually going to the right place.
Okay, so at face value, HTTPS just means it's encrypted.
Right, that's all it means.
Yeah.
Right.
But the identity has not been verified.
See, one of the issues here, and this is why you have to be very careful. Your friends could have had a Trojan on their machine that changed the host file, so you thought you were going to M&T Bank, and you ended up going to Fred's Podunk server in Oshkosh, and they stole your identity. In addition, and I want to scare everyone out there listening to this, that exchange can be made at a router as well. So when you go somewhere and use their free Wi-Fi, check you've gone to the right place every time. Now, if you're going to Facebook and you don't care if somebody steals your Facebook account and then starts posting child pornography in your name, then don't bother to check. But if you're just going to Google and looking something up, obviously you don't have to bother to check. But never, my philosophy is never do your banking in a public spot. whether it's your computer or somebody else's. Never do any kind of monetary transaction of any sort. Never do any kind of serious identity thing somewhere public. It's just not a good idea. It's just it just isn't.
Yeah, that I understand, but this is done right at my house over hardwire, so I think you saying I must have something in my computer that told it to do that.
Or you misspelled, typoed your bank name.
Mm-hmm.
Or there was an ad. There's been a lot of issues with ads popping up on legitimate web pages, and the ad has a Trojan in it. And so you think you're going to the right place, and you're not.
Right. So it's always best, once you have verified that you are in the right place, bookmark that, and then always go there using your bookmark.
Right, which is what I normally do on the other computer.
Right.
And I just went to Google and typed in the bank's name and clicked on the first one that came up.
Yeah, see, no.
And that might be an ad for a different bank. We see that a lot with the fake tech support. You know, you Google Microsoft Help or Windows Help or Apple Help, and you get three or four ads for companies offering Microsoft Help.
Right. Rather than pay the most money, right?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Exactly. The ads at the top of every Google search are people who have paid money to be at the top of every Google search. Usually they will say they have an ad or they have a different color background or whatever that may be, but it's usually subtle, so you have to look carefully for it before you go on to the next thing.
Okay, the bottom line is if I see that again and smell a rat, I click on the little lock, right?
Right, click on the little lock or just leave the site altogether and go there with your saved URL.
Okay, great.
Your bookmark. And on that machine where you had the issue, check your hosts file. You can search for it from the search box in Windows, and it's just called hosts, no extension.
It's in the Etsy directory, isn't it? Well, no, I'm thinking Unix.
Yeah, it is in the
in our computers here. It's in the Etsy
directory.
It's probably in the Win32 directory.
You can search for it; it'll bring it up. You can take a look at it. There's lots of places on the internet to tell you about it, but basically, you get an address and a name. So when you type in the name, it takes you to that address.
It's the internet phone book, basically.
Essentially, yeah.
So I just go to search and type in host file.
Just hosts.
Or hosts.
Just the word hosts.
Okay.
You may have to turn on searching system files.
Yes, yes, depending on what operating system you're using.
Yeah.
Right. Okie doke.
And you might want to do the full security tango on that machine.
If
there's anything you suspect might not be working right.
Always check the security tango at securitytango.com.
All righty.
For my friends at Channel 13 that I saw the other day, all of whom said, oh, I really have been meaning to dance the security tango. Wouldn't today be a great day to actually do it?
Yep.
Yes. Yes, it would.
Okay.
There's
I've got a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
As long as
we have Phil. Phil from Greece, New York on the mic.
For Steve, yes. Steve, I have an iMac. I bought it about 4 years ago. It's running version 10.6.8.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been looking into the issue of Mavericks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, are there any issues for me to upgrade to Mavericks?
There can be a couple issues. Mavericks is the current version of the Mac operating system, and it's version 10.9.
Mm-hmm.
So you're several versions behind.
Yeah, well, according to Mac, I'm still allowed to do it.
Yeah, it's 10.6 is still a supported OS.
The lowest supported.
It's not quite as bad as XP being unsupported completely.
Yeah.
Although I think 10.6 and XP came out about the same time. One nice thing that Apple's done over the years is that they've lowered the price of their OS upgrades. The 10.7 upgrade was $30, the 10.8 upgrade was $20, the 10.9 upgrade is free.
Yes.
So that's a big thing for you. The danger can be if you have any incompatible software. Because your OS is older, you're probably running older versions of other software, like Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm.
There are three big programs that are known incompatibilities that we always tell our customers about. Microsoft Office 2004 or earlier are not compatible with the later operating systems. Quicken 2004 or earlier and Apple Works, which used to come bundled on Macs for a very long time, is not compatible. Now, Apple Works got replaced in 2006. Office got replaced in 2008. Quicken got replaced in 2007. But
I got my computer 2010.
2010. So you might.
And I have. I think I have Word on there.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't think I use I don't use Quicken or Apple Works.
It might be the 2008 version then, or it could be the current version of Office for Mac is 2011. And both those are compatible.
Okay.
So that's the biggest thing to worry about when you're looking to upgrading your OS. Same thing on Windows. When you look at upgrading your OS, check your programs. There's a nice website that's a third-party community website called roaringapps.com. Because all the Apple code names used to be roaring cats, lion, mountain lion, snow leopard. So that you can type in the name of the program you're using.
Is that cats? Roaring Cats?
Roaring Apps, APPS. Okay. Because the OS was named after cats. So you can type in the program name you're interested in, and you can see if anyone else has reported compatibility issues with it. The other thing is that Apple has announced 10.10 Yosemite
yes.
is yeah. coming.
I was just looking because I was going to talk to you.
You'll be even farther behind. It's never a good idea to get too far behind,
but
you may not want to be at the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
So that's why in the Windows world, a lot of people are sticking with Windows 7 because it's so different than,
with
Windows 8. But on the Mac, it's not that bad.
Do you think I'd be able to just go right to Yosemite?
Probably. But because that's it's currently unreleased, they've announced it, but it's not shipping yet, we don't have any compatibility data on it. So you'd be safer going to Mavericks. And since that's a free upgrade anyway, the expectation is that Yosemite will also be free. It better be free. If the last one was free, the next one should be free.
Yeah, really.
But the other side of the coin is how much memory does the computer have?
Terabyte.
2 gigs is, that's probably disk space. Memory is...
Okay.
2 gigabytes is the stated minimum, minimum required.
Okay.
Highly recommended is at least 4. A gigabyte. I'm doing it again now. Yeah. Four gigabytes of memory, and more if your computer can handle it. So the more memory you have, the better everything runs.
Okay, so I should check my memory.
Yep, and you can on the Macintosh you can check that from the Apple menu in the upper left corner under the About This Mac Connect command, and that will tell you, in addition to the system version you're running, it tells you the processor you have and the memory you have installed.
Okay,
that's similar to properties under Windows.
Assuming it all looks good, then what do I do?
Make a full backup just in case something goes wrong.
Right.
And then you can go to the Mac App Store and download the Mavericks for free. It's about a 5 gigabyte file, so we usually let it run overnight.
Oh.
And if you have dial-up, forget it.
And that also means you've got to have at least 10 gig free on your hard drive.
That's no
Although 15 would be better.
With a terabyte hard drive,
on
you
my
probably
hard
have
drive,
tons.
My hard drive
right,
is probably...
Right, but I'm just saying...
We used to say 10%.
Yeah.
But now that terabyte hard drives are common, 1%.
1%. Yeah. Now, the hard drive, I don't know what my memory is.
Yeah.
I think it ought...
From a 2010 machine, it's probably 2. It might be 4.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So if it's...
Okay. If it's already 4, you're probably set.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And that's similar issues when you're upgrading your PC with Windows. You want to make sure you have enough RAM, enough free disk space, check your programs for compatibility, and always have a very good backup before you do anything major like upgrade your OS.
Right. In general, the number one upgrade that will make your machine run faster is more memory.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes. With Phil Dodd, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you, it's 39 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites right here on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Phil Dodd.
Well done, you. Who says Phil's not trainable? And at 42 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And Steve just had an interesting point about...
Yeah, there was a episode of Security Now recently where they were talking about a back door in commercial routers, port 32764. If you know, well, even if you don't, routers have different ports open to do things. Like the web is port 80, and so that port is typically what you use. And so some commercial routers, and apparently name brands from Cisco and Juniper, will have this port open to the WAN so that anyone on the internet can access your router and change the settings. Get a list of all the computers connected, getting a list of the passwords, getting all sorts of crazy stuff. And so GRC has a special website that they've created to get information on port 32764 and check your router for why that port might, or if that port is open, and then allowing you to close it if you can. So it's an interesting, with all this NSA stuff about backdoors and passwords and the iPhone backdoor news article we had a couple of weeks ago, this really weird high-end port that no one is quite sure what it's for is up there. And the rumor is that the NSA was able to convince the router manufacturers to put this port in there so they can spy on the bad guys. And the problem is, if you can spy on the bad guys, you can spy on the good guys too, and that's the whole furor now about NSA data collection, because they're collecting the good guys as well as the bad guys.
So there's a website you can go to check your home router that will tell you if that port is open. Now, closing that port, if it is open, it depends on what router you have and all kinds of things, so we can't give you generic instructions on how to do that. But somewhere in the manual that actually came with your router, oh, yes, it did. Don't tell me it didn't. You can check that stuff out.
And so, yeah, GRC.com has a free service called SpinRite. I'm sorry, no, SpinRite is the commercial hard drive program. They have a free service called Shields Up that will test all of the ports on your router to see if you are leaking any information out to the internet. And it's an interesting thing to run every now and then and see what is happening on your network that you might not know about. There's a couple of interesting things about, they have tests for HTTPS fingerprinting, going back to our first caller. If you work in a large enterprise corporation, the corporation often has a packet analyzer or a proxy server on the network that prevents you from going to bad places. And one of the ways they do that is by putting a security certificate in your computer that you use at work, because it's work's computer, not yours.
Right.
And so say you go to the bank on your lunch hour. Instead of being encrypted to the bank, it's encrypted to your company, and then the company makes a second connection to the bank. And GRC has a service that will check to see if this is happening in your company's computer.
Nice.
Yep.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ruth from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Ruth. What's up?
Hi. I just wanted to let Steve know. I called about two weeks ago having a problem with my Mac, and it was being slow to boot up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tried to do a safe boot, and it promptly went from slow boot to no boot.
Oops.
Spent 2 hours with Apple, and it turned out that my hard drive from 2009 was failing.
Ah, ouch.
So I ended up having to get a new hard drive. But Everything's well now, except I'm still trying to get all my stuff back.
Yep.
Yeah, right.
Oftentimes, that's what we're afraid of, the worst-case scenario. A computer being slow is the hard drive failing, because it's taking longer to read the data off the computer.
Yep.
Right, you called us back on 7/19. And that's why we always tell people, keep your backups current. That's the biggest thing that you can do. If you have good backups frequent backups, even constant backups, you're much better off. And I don't mean the entire operating system. To me, the important thing, well, of course, I run Linux, so everything is free. I could back up everything if I wanted to. But I back up my documents. The stuff that I have created is the important stuff to back up, or stuff that I really like. Pictures, obviously, of my family have to be backed up. But the rest of the stuff, I can always reinstall the operating system, or if I buy a new computer, it's got the operating system on it. What's really important is the stuff that, that I have created, or that is unique to me and my family.
Yeah, and so you have that peace of mind that if anything does go wrong with your hard drive, or even if you accidentally deleted a file a month ago and didn't realize it, that your backup has that second copy. And we get a lot of customers in our shop that, you know, our standard phrase is, would you cry if you lost everything on your hard drive? Well, yeah, I got all the pictures of my baby. Well, okay, you really want to spend the $100 to get a backup drive, because that's about all it is, less than $100 to get a backup drive and have a second copy of all your stuff, just in case.
How hard is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, just thought you'd like to know.
Yep.
Thank you, Ruth.
Also, I have a question for Mr. Dodd.
Yeah, sure. Oh, there you go.
Hey. Yes.
It's actually from my sister, who lives in Orchard Park, New York.
Okay.
Do you happen to have a set of relatives that live in Orchard Park, New York?
I do not.
Oh, okay. She was wondering, because she goes to Presbyterian women's meetings with Mrs. Dodd, and Mrs. Dodd thinks she might be related.
So, nope.
Distantly, maybe.
Unless it's distant, right.
Yep.
Yep.
If you go back far enough, we're
all right.
Well, that's true.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much.
Yep.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Thanks. Thanks, Ruth.
You may probably see me on the 30th.
Yep.
All
yep.
Right, good.
Good luck.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thanks,
bye.
Ruth. Yeah. Bye-bye.
And back to your point for a minute, Nick. Sometimes it is still important to back up your applications. We had a customer, I think, well, three or four customers in the last month, but one last week, where he lost his hard drive, didn't have a backup, and he can't find any of his original disks. Well, so what do I do on Microsoft Office? Well, just reinstall it from the original disk. I don't know where that is.
Yeah, that's an issue.
You have to find the disk, or you'll have to buy it again.
Right.
And that's one of the problems of using commercial software.
Right. And that's one of the things that I was saying about, you know, I run Linux, so everything is free. My Office suite is free. My editing tools are free. Everything is free.
And the same,
and all of those are available under Windows, but most people don't use them because they don't know about them.
And the Microsoft Office is the 800-pound gorilla that everyone's used to.
Right, right, right. Look, on Tuesday, the New York Times dropped an exclusive account of what reporter Nicole Perlroth called, and I quote, the biggest hack ever. By the numbers, it certainly held up. 1.2 billion accounts covering 500 million unique email addresses, over 420,000 websites. The data had been captured by a Russian hacker group called CyberVor and was revealed by Hold Security. But as the smoke clears, the hack seems to be less of a criminal masterwork than the article might have you believe. The biggest problem, as both Forbes and the Wall Street Journal have noted, is that Hold Security is already capitalizing on the panic, charging a $120 a year subscription to anyone who wants to check if their name and password are on the list. Hold says it's just trying to recoup expenses, but there's something unseemly about stoking fears of cybercrime and then asking concerned citizens to pay up. It also gives Hold a clear incentive to lie to reporters about how large and significant the finding was. Of course, facts are still facts, but even the hard data here are a little strange. If the idea of hacking 1.2 billion usernames sounds incredible, it should. There are just a handful of services with over a billion users. Facebook, Google Search, and Microsoft Office lead the pack, and if any of those were involved, Hold wouldn't be shy about saying so. Instead, these data come from hundreds of thousands of compromises over the course of months. Comparing it to breaches like Adobe or Target simply doesn't make sense. Both Perlroth's article and Hold Security's description stop short of saying the group actually stole all 1.2 billion passwords. They just eventually ended up with them. We already know the gang started out by buying data from earlier hacks, but it's remarkably unclear where the bought data end and the stolen data begin. Many of the passwords could have been old data from somebody else's hack. But what about the high-rolling corporate security involved? Hold Security says companies affected range from Fortune 500 companies to very small websites. But their technique is much better suited to small sites than major corporations. SQL injection is a powerful technique, but it's also a common one. Hackers have been using the attack for more than a decade, and any security professional would know to protect against it. It's always possible that a Fortune 500 company left themselves exposed. You should never underestimate incompetence, but it seems like a long shot. Most comparable hacks target Adobe, involved extensive search and multi-stage hacks that were tailored specifically to that company, much more sophisticated attacks than the one Hull describes. Clearly, Cyber4 has been busy, and they seem to have done real damage. Spammers are bad, and cracking small sites is just as bad as cracking big ones. But the most impressive aspects of the hack, the 1.2 billion accounts, the 420,000 sites, all have more to do with how the hack was framed than how it was carried out. And it's easy to see why. Nobody was going to pay $120 a year just to find out if their Twitter might get hacked. So you, are you worried about this massive hack? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
I can see how they wouldn't want to name names until they notify these companies that they were hacked. But the whole article just seems to be very weak on details.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know.
is it really true? Or yeah.
It's a reputable company. The Wall Street Journal is reputable, and all these places are reputable. But it just struck me that it's, you're right, very weak on details. And, you know, it doesn't pass the sniff test for me.
So is it just scaremongering to make you subscribe to their service to say, nope, not you?
Right.
I could do one of those, too. I just hacked 2 billion passwords. Pay me $100 a month, and I'll tell you if you're on the list.
Right, exactly.
Nope, you're not.
Nope, you're not. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. All right, our next caller is Rich from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Rich. What's up?
Hello, guys. Good afternoon. I'd like to extend the backup question. I'll give you a little situation, I guess. I have a desktop machine, a laptop machine, and then carry around a bunch of fobs once in a while to different machines at work and stuff. How do I keep that all backed up, we'll say, in one spot? If I'm doing different things on different machines or creating a document at work that I might want to save at home, we'll say, or things like that. And I understand the whole Google Docs thing and everything else, but I guess I'm looking at just the backup portion of it.
There's a couple of different methodologies, as there always is. You could buy a single backup hard drive for each computer and just leave it plugged in and let it back up. Or you could get a network-attached storage that is on your network, a single, much bigger hard drive that all of your computers back up to. And you can even use one computer to share a large hard drive with the standard file sharing built into Windows.
Now, could I do that through my home network and not off the home computer, or is it a drive that like needs to be connected to my router or something like that?
There's two types of drives. You can just get a regular big USB hard drive and share that to the network, and then tell a backup program on each computer to back up to that device. Or you can get what's called a network attached storage, or NAS, which is basically a hard drive with a little tiny computer in it, and you plug that directly to your network, and it shows up on the network as file storage, and so each computer can connect into that. Apple has a device they call the Time Capsule, which is a wireless router with a hard drive built into it, and so that can be your central network Wi-Fi access point and your backup service. Works with Macs and Windows, but generally works better with Macs. But any network-attached storage could do that, or even sharing a single hard drive. The other sort of aspect with backup drives is you sort of want to have an off-site backup as well. Say there's a fire or flood or theft in your house, and the computer and the backup drive next to it are both lost. So an off-site backup service, even using some of the free syncing services like Dropbox or Google Drive, works because then it's synced to another computer and synced offline. But the free services generally don't give you very much storage. Or you can use the commercial backup services like Carbonite or CrashPlan or one of those as well.
Are those safe enough for personal data such as my Quicken files.
Yep, generally, yes. Back to Gibson Research, Steve Gibson at GRC, has they did a roundup of all of the cloud sharing and backup services, and both Carbonite and CrashPlan encrypt the data on your computer before they leave your computer. So that the other end just has an encrypted blob of noise and they can't get into your data.
So using something like Dropbox though isn't a good idea. It's more better to use, like you say, one of these bigger companies?
A little bit, because Dropbox is encrypted at the other end, at their end. They can get into your data if they want to. They probably don't want to, but if there's a court order then, or a malicious employee, they could get in.
Sure.
The other thing some people do is just rotate hard drives. So you take a hard drive, back up your computer, and then take that drive to work and have a different hard drive at home so that you have separate hard drives in different locations as your off-site backup.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea either. It, like you said, with them being as cheap as they are, under $100, you know, two of them wouldn't be a bad deal.
How much space does Copy give you for free?
Well, and then there's a site called Copy.com. Great name, by the way. They encrypt at your desk, so it's encrypted at your computer, sent encrypted, stored encrypted, brought back encrypted, so it's all encrypted.
15 for free.
And you get 15 gigs for free. However, if you use a referral, like my referral number,
okay,
you get an extra 5 gig, and so do I.
So all the most of the services have something similar to that. I think I've got 10 gigs on Dropbox for free now.
Right.
And you can always buy more space on the services, but this is one of the largest free spaces that I've seen.
Right. And what they do is you run this on your desktop and or on your laptop and or on anything you want, and it synchronizes your, for example, documents folder across devices.
Like your Quicken file and your most important files.
Right.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, great. Thank you. I think you gave me some more things to think about and everything else, but I'll work with it.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Phil Dodd, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 59 minutes after the hour. Oh, this is a longer stop. We're going to be... we've lost an hour of our time today by just screwing around on the air, but we'll be doing it again for a whole nother hour. So come on back to see a whole lot more of Sound Bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Sound Bites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Phil Dodd.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Sound Bites, in case you didn't know that. Before we get back to the phones, let me remind you that on August 30th, which is Saturday, we will be celebrating our 25th anniversary. We will be broadcasting live from 11 Cup. From noon to 2, we'll be taking questions live. We'll be doing all kinds of cool things. So I'm personally looking forward to it. I may even show up. You never know. It might happen. Now, back to the phones. Paul from East Rochester. Hiya, Paul. What's up?
I've got a computer question about Windows 7. I actually have a Dell computer. Bought it on March 9th, 2011 from Best Buy. You know, the Geek Squad people.
Yep.
And the issue that I'm having with it is if you unplug it from the power source, either turn off the power, off the master switch or unplug it from the power source and you plug it back in, it will beep like 5 times and then complain that it'll go back to a strange, obscure date. So the workaround that I've been doing is just leaving it plugged in, leaving the power thing turned on, so it doesn't do this to me. I'm wondering if it is the CMOS battery.
That's exactly what it is. Like, well done, Paul.
Is it a desktop or a laptop?
It is one of those Dell Inspiron 2320 all-in-one.
Desktop,
it's,
okay, yeah.
Plug everything into the back of the computer, USB,
yep.
Modem, USB. It's all USB.
Yeah, so it probably is the CMOS yep. battery on yep. the inside.
Yeah, that's exactly
how
what
do
it
you,
is.
How do you get to that? I mean, I'm a visually impaired person. Who would be able to do this for me? Could well, a
theoretically,
friend do it for
the
me with no problem?
A friend could likely do it. I don't. I am not honestly familiar with exactly what the battery situation is on the Dell right. Inspiron all-in-ones.
It's usually a CR2032, but
right. it's,
not
it's
always.
That, it's that coin-shaped.
What's the name of that again?
CR2032. It's usually in the watch bat.
CR2032, and then it should stop beeping. It's only been like 2 years. Do they only last 2 years, and then they start
no,
complaining?
No, well, here's the thing.
You had a power switch that you turn things off with?
Yeah.
That
I turn it off. If I'm going to turn it off, I'd like to turn it off, ideally with the master switch, because
right.
I have lots of interference with radios. I
right.
own a shortwave
so
radio.
That
like
cuts.
To listen to shortwave broadcasts once in a while, mm-hmm. and that will definitely interfere with that. So
right.
if I turn off the actual power source to the computer, the
which
master
means
switch,
that during those
then I won't
times,
get any interference.
Which means that during those times, Paul, when there is no other power coming into the machine, then it's the battery that has to act on the time.
So you're draining
right.
the battery faster.
Okay.
Right. So you and they give you an average life of 5 years. Well, as we all know, average is
below
just a lie.
Average for sure.
Well, not necessarily. You know, one battery lasts 10 years, another battery's dead out of the box, that's an average of 5 years.
Why is it only lasting me 2 years?
Because some batteries, yeah. you know, you're using it more.
If you left the computer powered from the wall, then it wouldn't use the battery much at all,
right.
and it may last
little,
20 years.
If you turned off the computer but left the master switch on,
uh-huh.
then it would still get a little trickle of energy and would not use that battery.
Right. That's what I'm doing at this point.
Right. And that should help.
If I unplug the computer and plug it back in, I could even give you a demonstration, but I don't think you want to hear the noise that it makes when you
I know
you're
the noise that it makes,
that.
And that is the reason. So if you also don't forget, Paul, that battery may have a life of 5 years, but how long was that battery in that machine before you bought it?
The Dell website
says
2 or 3 years.
I'm not sure, but I think when I initially bought the machine,
years.
The operating
two,
system two. Said 11:59 p.m. December 31st, 2010.
Right. Well, that's neither here nor there. According to Dell's website, that battery lasts for 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
So you're done. It's time to change the battery. Steve,
what's the name of the battery again?
CR20.
CR.
Yeah. For and 2032.
2032, yeah. And where can I get this battery at?
Most any store that sells watch batteries.
CR2032.
Yep. It's a small watch type battery, about the size of a quarter. So it's for a really big watch.
CR2032.
C as in Charlie, R as in radio.
It is often that battery, but it may not be in your specific case. You'll need to check your manual to see if it gives you the battery number. Or you'll have to take the computer apart to see what the battery in it is.
Yeah. Okay. So we know it is the battery for sure. That's why it's doing
yeah,
this.
Yep. Exactly.
Especially when the date and time fails.
Yeah, the date and time fail, and it says, press F1 for BIOS setup.
Yep.
Right, it's exactly right.
It says,
that's exactly what it is.
And then it just has this weird message that pops up.
Yep,
yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
You know that. The hard drive is fine, and I've got a backup drive like you've been talking about stressing, and I personally, when I had a Mac, I had a backup drive, and I've had a backup drive since I've had a Mac and switched back to Windows 7, and
good
I do not want to switch to Windows 8, ever.
Yep.
Well, yeah, you know what? That's going to happen eventually. Maybe you'll get to
Windows
9. Skip 8 entirely
nine.
And go right to 9.
That's true. 9 will be like Windows 7.
Yep. Maybe. We
yeah,
hope so.
Possibly. The odd numbers tend to
all right. Thank you very
for
much,
someone
Paul.
That's got a visual impairment, they better make sure they have all the kinks out of it. That's all
yeah.
I'm asking.
Well, exactly.
Well, and that's sort of the irony is that the operating systems with their graphical interfaces are really, I want to say, designed for people to
who
see.
Who can see fine.
Who can see fine, right. So trying to adapt that to someone with a visual impairity has been kind of tricky over the years. It was a lot easier in the DOS days when there's just a command there.
Another thing is, one more question. I have Viper Internet Security. How would you guys rate that? Have you ever heard of it?
Viper?
V-I-P-R-E.
You know what? I have not.
It's an antivirus program, and it will also protect you when you're surfing online, and I wanted to let your listeners know that I highly recommend it. The price for the lifetime license is $99.99.
That's not bad.
And you get one PC, one lifetime license. You'll never have to buy an upgrade again.
Nice. That's not bad. Well, I'll check it out. Thank you so much, Paul.
You're welcome.
It's good to know. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Good to know. Viper, V-I-P-R-E. I'll look it up. I'll check
European
into
spelling.
It. Viper. Viper.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. You know, there's a lot of them out there, and most of them are good. We just don't have the time to check them all out as much as we'd like to. But this one looks pretty nice. I'll do some testing. I'll do some looking out at the internet. We'll see what we get. In the meantime, we'll go back to the phones and we'll talk to Jack from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Jack. What's up?
Quick question here. I listen to your show a lot, and I usually try to get over the internet streaming because I don't get a good signal here in Brighton for some reason. But I usually use Firefox. However, I just can't seem to get, when I click on your link, either high speed or low speed for that matter, it tries to bring up the Shockwave streaming utility, and it just never completes. So I end up having to close it and go to Explorer. It does work on Internet Explorer, but not on Firefox. I was wondering if you could explain why.
Oh, that's interesting.
It might be a file association error. It's trying to load an MP3 stream, and you need to have an MP3 streaming program in your computer. And apparently somewhere along the way, your computer got told that Shockwave was the MP3 streaming program. Usually if you install a different MP3 streamer,
VLC.
VLC, Winamp is gone now.
Winamp
isn't it?
Is still there.
Oh, they brought it back?
Yes, and it continues to whip the llama's ass.
This has happened with Microsoft Media Player as well.
Yeah, something else got set to be the default player. And so you can go into the preferences of your preferred player, and oftentimes there is a set preferred player command for .mp3 or .m3u is the streaming link. The last link that says listen on your smartphone is a straight .mp3, and that MP3 player should be built right into all the browsers without needing
a
third-party plugin.
But yeah, the easiest, can you right-click and pick a different?
Not on a link. But if you find an MP3 on your computer, right-click on and choose properties on, not properties, open with on the desktop. Then you can choose which program you want to open MP3s with. And theoretically, then the browser will know that.
Right. Or as Steve said, if you install something like VLC, read each screen carefully, because at some point one of them will come up and say, do you want VLC to be your default player? And then it lists all the possibilities that it could be the default to.
And you can even reinstall Windows Media Player and do that. It's usually that final act of installing is what sets the default player.
Right.
Okay, well, I'll give that a try. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thanks. Yeah, everything wants to be the default, and so that often comes up with that kind of an issue. Oops. And there's nothing. Phil, the
drop the level. Sorry,
code on the thing.
The level on the phone. Yeah, all the way down. We're done. Thanks.
There we go.
So Phil was answering one call. We finished with another call and threw him off.
Yep. That's it. Phil is doing an amazing job here. Only it's. It's not easy. It's not easy. Dave, who's been doing it for years now, also sometimes freezes and starts screaming at the top of his lungs.
Yeah, but it's like every program that can play certain types of media, whether it's MP3 or Shockwave or Flash or QuickTime or Windows Media, every player thinks it's going to be the only player. And so you install that player, and it sets itself to play everything. Well, maybe I want to use another program for MP3s and a different program for FLVs and a different program for MOVs. The annoying thing is you have to know what all those are.
Yeah, exactly right.
Or call us and we'll help and tell you.
Well, every program does that when you install Office.
Yeah, every DOC will now open in Office.
Right.
What if I wanted to use, you know, Apache or Libre?
Right. There becomes an issue there. But generally, it's not an issue. But when you install something like Shockwave, and it takes over everything, that's an annoyance.
Yeah, Real used to do that, and we hated how bad. In fact, thank God Real is pretty much gone.
Pretty much. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Dick from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Dick. What's up?
Router question.
Router question.
Yes. Any idea what would require or what would make my router, why I would have to constantly stick a paperclip in the back of the reset button on the router, or pull its power cord out and then let it reset so it shoots the signal down to the first floor? Is it time to replace it?
yeah, it's probably dying.
Yep. Have you tried looking for a firmware update?
Okay. No, I haven't. How would I do that? Go online to D-Link and
The manufacturer, and then you put in the model number and version number of that router and see if there is a firmware update, and they'll have instructions on how to update the firmware.
Very good.
Sometimes
very good. I'll try that, and if that fails, then maybe...
Time for a new router. Do you know if it's a G or an N?
I do not know, but would that make a difference?
Well, the current standard is AC, so if it's a G, you definitely want a new one. If it's an N, you might want a new one.
But if it's a GN, say that again.
G is a very old standard, so you probably want a new router anyway.
Okay, G is very old, N is not as old, and you said a newer one.
AC is the current version.
AC. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Thanks.
Bye.
Apparently they ran out of letters, A through Z, so we had AA, AB, now AC.
Right. I did want to also mention that when we were talking about copying, copy.com, if you don't like the 15 or 20 gig, you get 250 gig for $100 a year.
That's pretty good.
Or $10 a month. Yeah, it's a real good thing. And by the way, they're affiliated with Barracuda Networks, which is a very well-known company. So that's pretty neat.
They have heart. No, sorry.
What?
They have heart.
They have heart. They have Barracuda hearts. So that's pretty neat, and there's some nice stuff there. Like I said, I use it all the time.
Now remember that sync means make the both the same. If you delete something from your sync folder, it gets deleted from all the other computers' folders.
Right. And that's an important thing.
Yeah, sync is not backup.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller, Roy from Pittsford, New York. Hi, Roy, what's up?
Good afternoon. This is a follow-up on that earlier call with regards to the backup battery.
Yes. Yep.
I have an E-Machines Model T2792, which started experiencing the same problem about 6 months ago. It's a backup machine. So I finally got around to saying, well, let me open it up and look for a battery in there. I looked all around, and I can't find a battery in there anywhere.
It's probably on the backside of the motherboard. So you have to...
Think so?
If you don't see one on the front side, it's probably on the back side.
One of the issues that we have as users is that the days of popping open a machine and replacing this and that and the other thing are fairly much gone. Almost everybody for these all-in-ones and as well as for laptops uses that kind of all-in-one board that laptops normally use, because they're cheaper to make. If I'm already making a laptop and I've got a motherboard for that, how hard is it to stick that exact same motherboard up against the back of a monitor and now I'm selling an all-in-one?
Well, this is a desktop.
Well, all right. So for that, it's a little different. It depends, again, on how many cards you have in the machine, where those cards are. Some of the old, how old is this E-Machine?
How old is it?
Yeah.
It's probably 7 years old, I would guess.
Yeah, some of the older machines didn't use that coin battery. They used little blue barrel batteries. and those barrel batteries were soldered onto the motherboard.
Yeah.
And if they were socketed, there it's a the one half double A, which was very annoying.
Yeah. I've looked carefully for anything. I did not look on the back of the motherboard because it's kind of hard to get to.
Yeah. There may be a section in the manual that talks about the battery and replacing the battery.
Yeah, I can't find a manual for it.
Yeah, that's the other.
I've looked on the web, and I guess it's too old a machine.
Yeah, that becomes an issue. Yep. I don't know why they don't leave that stuff up there. All it's taking is a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of disk space.
Mm-hmm. A terabyte hard drive for $100. Yeah. Well, and what sort of has happened now is that because computers are connected to the internet pretty much all the time, as soon as your computer boots, both Windows, Mac, and Unix, it checks the internet time server and fixes the clock. So most people don't notice that their battery is dead.
Right.
Right.
And unless you get the error before it starts.
Well, I thought perhaps you might know who made the motherboard.
No, I'm afraid we don't, and we got to take a break.
Okay.
Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Phil Dodd, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, Sound Bites. Member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And he's Phil Dodd, and it's 23 minutes after the hour, and we are Soundbites. Do we have somebody? No, we don't. Okay, good. In that case, I'll go back to the news. Yahoo users may have benefited most from the Snowden effect. The tech company was a laggard when it came to security practices until the NSA leakers' disclosures made clear the extent to which weak security practices by tech companies are being exploited by talented hackers. It's since hired a respected security researcher, Alex Stamos, no relation, to beef up the company's practices, and the results have been relatively swift, starting in April with the rollout of encryption on Yahoo services so that it's not as easy for the NSA and other intel agencies to suck up data, sometimes of the intimate variety, en masse from Yahoo users. At Black Hat in Las Vegas on Thursday, Stamos announced that the encryption train is making another stop. Yahoo plans to add end-to-end encryption to Yahoo Mail, following in Google's footsteps. Starting in the fall, Yahoo users will be able to send messages to other Yahoo Mail users and Gmail users that look like gibberish to anyone but the sender and the recipient. Now, this, in both cases, assumes you're using the web-based version of the email. If you read your email in something like Thunderbird, that may not work. So if an activist in Sudan wants to email a human rights organization's Gmail address and they have encryption set up for it, it will automatically detect that and offer them the option to encrypt, said Stamos, who emphasized that encryption technologies need to be easy for people to use. Yahoo plans to modify the end-to-end encryption plugin that Google has already developed. Yahoo has hired privacy engineer Yan Zhu from the Electronic Frontier Foundation to help develop the technology. The subject line of an email won't be encrypted, but the contents of the message will, meaning that Yahoo can't see it, or anyone else who intercepts it can't see it while it's in transit. The scanning, the problem with encrypting messages from a business perspective is that it prevents Yahoo from scanning them for advertising purposes, but Stamos was unworried about that. We predict no revenue impact from end-to-end encryption, he said. The ticket to Las Vegas that United emails you and that we use to display Vegas ads to you is never going to be encrypted, he said. That kind of stuff will, the kind of stuff that will be encrypted, such as email to your mom or that from an activist, doesn't have a lot of commercial value. What about other business possibility that it helps Yahoo attract new users? Privacy is much more effective as a selling point than it used to be, said Stamos. It's still not a great selling point, but it's getting better. So did you pick Gmail because it does encryption? Will you be happy when Yahoo does start encryption? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
And that's sort of the problem with most email clients like Thunderbird, Eudora, even Mac Mail. They don't set up secure mail by default because almost nobody uses secure mail at the other end.
Right.
So now there's two sort of aspects to it. There's SSL during transfer. So you can tell your mail program to use SSL during transfer, which encrypts the data between you and the mail server. Not all mail servers support that. Google, right. Yahoo, Apple does support that. Annoyingly, Time Warner, with their Roadrunner mail server, does not support SSL, but with their TWC mail server, it does.
Yeah.
Crazy. Then there's the storage of the mail. The mail gets stored on that server before it's sent on to the next server. And during storage, the mail is almost never encrypted. And so partly because of the NSA leaks, most of these big mail providers are saying, let's just start doing secure mail all the way along.
Yep, encrypted right from the beginning.
Yep.
And then no matter where it stops, it's still encrypted, and it gets decrypted at the end.
Yep.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ed from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Ed. What's up?
Hi, good afternoon. I was just curious if you can change font sizes. Let me just give you an example. At work, where we use Microsoft 7, and you can go in and change things on, for lack of a better term, the first program. But the one that we utilize, we have to go in to another program, and I'm being told at work that you can't change any of the font sizes on it. It's already preset. I wonder if that's, number one, true, and if you can somehow get around that to
Without knowing what the programs are, Ed, we can't really help you.
The two general things you can do is both Windows and the Mac have a zoom function where it will magnify a piece of the screen or the entire screen and make it look bigger.
Right.
But then it cuts off the edges because you're zooming in on the screen.
Are you looking to make it bigger to print or to view?
No, to view. Because you have to, you're constantly pulling up work orders, and the way they have it preset, you just can't make the type a little bit bigger.
Yep.
That's quite likely because you're probably getting something like a PDF something.
Or a DOS terminal.
Or it's a DOS terminal. Is it a Windows machine or is it?
No, it's a Dell, and then it uses a Microsoft 7.
Windows. Yeah. The other thing you can do, so the zooming function is in the Windows control panel. It's usually under user access or what is the other word they use? Ease of use. It's basically the handicapped access for people with visual impairments. You can zoom the screen.
And just last week, so it's still on the front page of soundbites.org. We have an article called "Make Items on the Screen Appear Bigger."
Mm-hmm.
And with the zoomer.
I think it's Control A, and then if you move the scroll, it'll come and it'll. But this one must be preset, or because you can't do it to the second program, you have to get into your use for work.
Well, you can do it to the entire screen, so you make the whole screen magnify, and so it doesn't matter what program you're in; the screen is magnified.
Right, but I've tried that, and it just ignores you; won't do it.
Well, then you're not getting into the magnifier program, right?
Listen, check out the link that we put in our little story there.
Yep.
And see if that helps you in any way, and if it's different from what you're using now.
Maybe.
Okay, appreciate it.
Yep.
Thanks a lot.
Take a look at it and see what it's like. Thanks.
Yeah. The other thing you can do is lower the resolution on your monitor to make everything look bigger, but then it gets fuzzier and less clear.
Right.
And so that becomes the choice. You can have clear text or you can have big text, but not necessarily both.
Right. And it also depends on what Ed is using to view with.
Yeah.
If it's a program that they've written, it certainly is possible that you can't change anything.
Right.
If it's something like the standard Adobe
mm-hmm.
PDF reader, you can generally zoom that in if you want to.
But you should be able to do a screen zoom because that's OS level.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, our next caller is Joe from Cheektowaga, New York. Welcome, Joe. What's up?
Well, I might have misheard this. I'll admit that. But one of your first callers was talking about logging into his bank, and he said he entered some security questions. I didn't quite catch this. It sounded like he actually went to a different page. So,
yeah,
mm-hmm. me personally, I would be calling up my bank, getting in touch with them, and saying, "I need to change my security questions.
Change your password. Somebody,
somebody might have them."
One thing I have seen banks do, my bank does it, is when you're on an unfamiliar computer to the bank and try to log in for the first time, it makes you answer your security questions or gives you a security token
right.
to authorize that computer. It's a second factor authentication. And then the caller said after he did that, it jumped him to a different page. And so, yeah, it was a good point that we might not have caught, that he might have given his security questions to the bad guy, and it'd be a good idea to get his password, too, and his security questions changed on that bank.
Right. Yeah, so, Mike, if you're still listening, and I'm sure you are, because what else are you going to do in Altoona, PA? Call your bank. Was it him? Anyway, it was somebody.
I think it was Mike in Altoona.
Yeah.
Good call, Joe. They put a cookie in your browser that says, the server has seen your computer before and probably has a long expiration on it. Yeah. That my bank does that, too. I also noticed that they did outsource it, too, because you go to my bank's main web site and you click on, do online banking, and it goes to a totally different domain. So, that's pretty tricky. You got to kind of pay attention, I guess.
I am impatiently waiting for the day when everybody uses two-factor authentication.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's the unfortunate thing. When I have to call a CSR, like the last time I called a bank that holds my mortgage. So, you guys thinking about two-factor authentication? No, not yet.
Yeah, right.
They're still running on a System 36. They're lucky you have 8-character passwords.
Golly. Also, I'd like to say a word of caution about taking your backups to work. I mean, I guess that's better than nothing, but I'll just describe the last time I had to part ways with a company.
Yeah.
It was their policy that when they tell you, it's time to no longer to work here, you don't even get to go back to your desk. They bring what they're pretty sure are your possessions to where they're telling you this information, and you go bye-bye. So,
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't take anything to work. I would use an online service.
Because you were the boss at your work.
Well, that's right. I was the guy who ran the computers, so really there wasn't anybody to... I was the guy who did that to other people.
Yep.
You were the top dog almost. Okay,
Yeah,
that's true. If you have a very good relationship with the people you work with, or their policies are a little more lax than where I was, or you own the place, it's perfectly fine. That's a very good strategy.
Right.
If you really wanted to, you could hire somebody like Iron Mountain, which does that for a living. It takes offsite backups.
Yep.
Physical offsite backup,
right.
But probably a little expensive for a lot of people. The other thing that was kind of scary that I heard about recently was USB drives. Gosh golly, they, if you stick them in a computer that might probe it a little bit, it might turn into a keyboard and start doing things like, entering commands to delete your whole hard disk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about this last week, and it's kind of scary.
Don't stick foreign things in your computer.
That's right. What can happen is that the USB stick has actually two areas of memory in it. One is the area that you use to store things. The other has the USB code in it. And that code can be taken over and added to by the bad guys. So when you stick that USB drive in your machine, it puts a virus or a Trojan or whatever you want to call it into your computer to then do more mischievous things. So having that USB drive in your machine is the very thing that infects you. And of course, that's not caught by standard antivirus software checks. So you can say, when this goes into the drive, automatically do a scan, a virus scan, to see that it's clean. Even if that drive is empty and the machine thinks it's clean, it's only checked the main memory, not the memory inside the USB itself.
That's how the Stuxnet virus got into the Iranian nuclear plants.
Right.
They tossed USB keys in the parking lot. Someone picked one up. Trying to be helpful, I'll put it in the computer, see if I can tell who it is, and give it back to them. Well, that's how the virus can bridge those air gaps, they call them now.
Yep.
Well, think about how scary that is, too. In order to increase security, there's a lot of systems that use USB tokens that you insert the token in order to be able to complete authentication.
Have to trust who made the token.
You kind of wonder about those, too.
Yep, and if that's gotten infected, which it can be infected, now you've infected your machine. You've infected every machine you put that in. If you're on a network, you may have infected the whole network. It gets scary.
Yep. And it's not necessarily, well, not the computer's problem. It's the USB dongles. It was like with the Target security breach. It wasn't Target's computers. It was the POS system that came from the factory already infected.
Right. And we used to see that every once in a while from the companies. Back in the day, before we all had internet, the computer clubs would get disks from various services. And every once in a while, one of those services would get infected and then send out infected disks.
And the point at the club is to pass out those disks to everyone else.
Yeah, that's the point, right.
Yeah.
So there have always been issues with that, and you always have to be super careful.
Oh, and as far as your lead story goes, gosh, I wish I had more than 1 megabit up because, you know, I back up my Nexus 7 tablet to the cloud.
Yeah.
And it's just agonizingly slow I run Titanium backup every day and I say, oh, sync to Google Drive. It typically takes at least 15 minutes a day.
Yeah. Yep. Do you have a data cap?
Not that I know of. No, I'm a Time Warner customer.
Time Warner Buffalo still doesn't do data caps.
Right.
But I have the option of Fios, but it's more expensive per month. Yeah. So that's
something to keep in mind when you look about an online backup system. Is do you have a data cap, and that's going to count?
Yeah, exactly.
The online backup services, some of them have a jump start sort of feature where you send them a hard disk with your initial backup, too.
Yeah.
That's another thing to look for.
All right, we got to go. Thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes. Steve Ray, Phil Dodd, me, Nick Francesco, and you, 39 minutes after the hour. Sound bites on the solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Hi, I'm Nick Francesco. Along with Dave Enright and Steve Ray, I host Sound Bites, America's longest running computer talk show. We're celebrating 25 years on the air, Saturday, August 30th, from 12 noon to 2 p.m., with a live broadcast at Love & Cup, located at Park Point at RIT. Food and beverage will be available for purchase. For more information on this event, you may visit jazz901.org. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Phil Dodd.
Hey!
And at 42 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. While Apple's Siri has been an iOS staple since 2011, the tech has yet to make the jump to OS X. An exhaustive new patent filing, however, details a very similar desktop version of the virtual assistant that can perform dictation, high-level system commands, and even act as a third hand for Mac users. As published by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office on Thursday, Apple's massive 92-page patent application for an intelligent digital assistant in a desktop environment described a technology that goes far beyond Mac's current voice dictation feature and can easily be considered a Siri for Mac. Like the current iteration of Siri, limited to iOS, Apple's desktop version is able to process natural speech and text input to perform actions like completing tasks, inputting and retrieving data, conducting searches, and more. Further, the filing points out that commands are to be taken in context based on deduced user intent. In other words, Siri for desktop will use speech recognition to decipher and remember contextual clues. In some embodiments, an icon of the virtual assistant can reside in the dock, notifying the user that it is active and ready for service. This and other modes allow the user to speak commands and start dictations from anywhere in the operating system. Voice input is of specific importance to the patient's disclosures, as the technology is looking to augment keyboard and mouse input, or in some cases replace the physical tools altogether. The usual answer response method seen with Siri for iOS is applied to the desktop variant, although more advanced operations can be performed, giving the extra computing power afforded by a proper computer. Apple's desktop Siri uses a focus selector, or mouse cursor, as we call it, to help users apply context to a command. For example, the assistant can perform a copy operation for an asset under a hovering cursor, or may hold a batch of highlighted files for later retrieval. In essence, the focus selector plays the same role as an iOS device user's finger, except with substantially more options for control, thanks to the Mac's GUI. With mouse access, users can drag and drop files, folders, and other assets onto the Siri dock icon for processing. For example, a folder full of pictures can be sorted by telling the assistant, sort by date or sort by location, which is a whole lot easier than clicking on sort by date or sort by location. Following completion of the operation, a secondary command may be issued, or the icon may throw up a list of extra options in text or voice form. Multiple assets can be dragged and dropped onto the assistant for advanced collation, merging, and advanced comparison operations. A number of other operations are also described in the full patent document. So are you excited about Siri for Mac? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
One thing that's been annoying over the years is that Apple has had voice commands built into the Mac for 20 years. And it's never caught on because it's always been slow. You have to enunciate very plainly and speak very plainly. And we want it to work like it does on Star Trek. Just tell the computer what you want to do. But they've been adding more and more things over the years. And now that Siri can do it on the phone, the computer should be able to do it too.
Yep.
So it's probably more the back end processing that they have so many hundreds of millions of devices. They don't want to add another 100 million and bog down their system.
Well, but I've been everybody's been able to do this with Google now.
Yeah.
You know, if you have Chrome, you can do it directly out of your browser. Just go to Google, and I don't know that it works with the others, but I know it works with Chrome.
Yeah.
You can do search by voice. You can do all of that other stuff. I can do dictation. I've got a great program that does dictation.
Yeah.
So it's not something new, which will be interesting to see how patentable that is. But it is, I have to say, a nice step forward. The problem has always been drag and dictate, and a couple of others have done that sort of thing before.
Yeah, dictation and command are sort of two sides of speech.
Right, right, right. And with dictation, you pointed this out last week. Dear sir, return. On your email of the 25th, we wanted to say, quote...
They're getting better at guessing the punctuation, right. But if you speak the punctuation, it works better and you don't have to edit it so much later.
Right. That's always been true, but now with commands,
yep.
Save and whatever... But the problem is if you have a noisy environment.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy in the next cubicle says erase hard drive. And your hard drive gets erased.
Yeah. Yep. You're right. The guy's on the phone who said, I don't know, I think I may have erased my hard drive.
Yep.
Oops. Or, we saw this when Siri first came out and I was teaching. At the end of class, 20 students would take out their phones and that distinctive Siri beep would go off. And somebody would always yell, call mom.
Yep.
And 20 phones would call mom.
Yep.
And now the kids got to explain, no, mom, I didn't mean to call you. I didn't want to talk.
You never call me anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's kind of an Easter egg built into the Apple speech command. There's a folder called speakable items that lists the dozens of commands it can do. And one of them is tell me a joke. And it knows some really bad jokes.
Yeah, well, Siri does that too.
Yeah.
It's a terrific thing, but the problem, the question is going to be how useful will it really be?
And on the Mac, it's sort of hidden under the accessibility options for people, again, with visual impairments, that you can speak your commands to it because you can't see it, or you have a motor impairment and can't type the commands.
Right.
So that's sort of, it's always sort of been regulated down to there and doesn't have, you know, foremost access in the OS.
Right, and now they're bringing it front and center. So it's not really a new thing. It's a repurposing thing, I think, more likely.
Somebody remembered, we have that.
I will say the other day I was doing a crossword puzzle and it gave some the last name of some tennis player who I knew who she was and I just couldn't think of her first name. So I was just sitting there and I just without moving, I just went, okay, Google. My phone went da-ding. And I said, whatever the last name was, and it said, blah, 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 is a tennis player. Oh, blah, blah, blah. That's right. I got it. Thank you very much. And I could write it down. And that's something people could certainly use on the desktop easily. But a lot of the rest of it, I don't know. I honestly don't know how much easier it is to say, copy this file than it is to just drag it yourself.
Yep. But that's what we see in the TV shows and science fiction for years.
Right.
Leading a ragtag fugitive fleet. You know. Commander Adama's been dictating his log for 30 years.
And it's punctuated perfectly.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. The poor guy never goes back and says, no, what I meant to say was. And
well,
they don't do that very well.
It's Adama. He says the right thing the first time all the time.
Exactly. But that's the issue with... if you've ever given dictation, you know that sometimes you go back and say, scratch that. I wanted to say this instead.
Yeah.
And you wander on and you think, all right, give me a second. Let me think about this. And you think out loud for a second. And that's all in there. Or you say, as I just did, you think out loud.
Yep.
And it writes that. Now you've got to go back and edit it all over again.
What was the one test I liked? Wreck a nice beach versus recognize beach.
Nice.
So they sound very or how things pronounce police. Is it police or police?
Yep. So and interestingly, one of the cool things that Google has been doing is crowdsourcing all that stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things you can do is when somebody sends you Google a voicemail. If you're using an Android phone, you can have Google Voice deal with that voicemail. And one of the things it will do is then translate that into a text message and send you the text message. It also puts it in Google Voice. So if you go to the website, you have the option to help fix the translation.
Yeah. And that makes it better at the other end.
And if they get, and they do have currently millions and millions of people who diligently correct all their transcriptions.
Yep.
And that does nothing but help Google's voice analyzer get better and better.
Yep.
Because you know as well as I do, when you get up first thing in the morning, turn on the computer.
Yep.
You know, it is way different from after you've had that first cup of coffee, turn on the computer.
Or
before you're about to go to bed, turn on the computer.
Or you get a cold or...
Right.
Yep.
Right. And that's been a problem since day one. A lot of the, which is why they quickly stopped using, you know, we see it on television all the time, but in the real world, voice print is not the way you do things. You do it with
my voice is my passport.
Scanning.
Verify me.
Right. You do it with eye scanning and you do it with other stuff because voice recognition is easy to have a problem with. The other day, I went to the dentist and I spent the next 4 hours sounding like this. If I'd been using voice recognition, I would never have gotten anything done.
And that's kind of the irony with computers. Computers do math really, 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 really good, and people don't.
Right.
People do speech very, very, very good, and computers
really
don't.
Really, really well.
Yep.
And that's always been an issue.
Yeah.
You know, computers, I mean, we spend a lot of time doing text things, reading or writing on a computer, but computers don't understand text. They don't have any idea what text is. They really, truly don't.
Yeah.
So it's an issue. So, for example, today I was looking at how do I do an index in a document? Well, there's really kind of three ways to do it. Every word, none of the words, or every word longer than X, mm-hmm. which will get rid of and the. But if you wanted to index an, as in the woman's name, A-N-N, you missed it.
Yep. You need three-letter indexing.
Right, right. So it be it
index
becomes,
too much or index not enough.
Well, exactly right. And so and I'm not, and there are ways around that, and there are algorithms that deal with that. But the point is that's just a piece of the problem that has to be dealt with. And is Bill a first name?
Yep.
Or something that's not going to make it through Congress this year?
Bill Posters will be prosecuted.
Right.
Save Bill Posters.
Release Bill Posters now.
Yeah.
No prosecution. So it becomes an issue. It also becomes an issue for things like Cheektowaga.
Mm-hmm.
Skinny Atlas. Go ahead.
We are probably pronouncing it wrong compared to the original native pronunciation.
Right. Go ahead and try to get any computer anywhere to correctly type out Skinny Atlas. When you say Skinny Atlas,
I can't even spell it myself. How's the computer going to know?
And we were talking about last night. When I was a kid, up at Shalott Beach, there's no R in Shalott.
Yep.
There's no L in Albany. You know, those are local affectations. It's like Worcestershire.
Mm-hmm.
It's Worcestershire, but everybody there pronounces it Worcestershire. And it's in local affectation, and getting your computer to understand that takes some time and effort. Whereas the humans understand it immediately. If I said to you, "Let's go up to Shalott Beach," you don't stop and say Shalott. What Shalott? There's no.
Yeah.
I know Charlotte or Charlotte.
Yeah.
So
Gene Shalott.
Gene Shalott. Let's go up to Shalott Beach and have a nice something to eat. All right. Look, that's it. We're done. For another week, I don't want to hear any more about this. Well, we're gonna take a week off. We're gonna not come back till next Saturday. I don't like that. That sounds good to me.
That'll
I want to thank
you.
Phil Dodd, who did an amazing job here today, particularly since he had so little notice about this and did great. Now, look, don't go away. George is coming in to play the best German music you will hear all week. So sit back and relax, and get your German on. I suppose I shouldn't say don't get to get your schnitzel on. I don't even know what that means. So we're done for another week. See you next week with the longest running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.